Pushkin.
Most people in this country need a lot of things, and we can afford them, and we can make sure that people who contribute to the profits and the wealth of our economy are getting their fair share. And yet the coalition that could make that happen on a consistent way is splintered because of racism.
Racism is harmful, not just to Black people, not just to Indigenous people, not just to Asian Americans and Latinx Americans, to everyone. And while the harm done to people of color is plain to see, we're often blind to the ways racism also harms white people. I'm Ibram X. Kendi, and this is Be Anti-Racist. Now, I'm not stating that racism harms white people to the same extent that it does people of color. I'm stating that the racism of white people can harm white people too. I'm an historian, a storyteller. Let me tell you a story. It takes place in 1847. Tensions were running high in the United States. 2 years prior, Congress had voted to annex Texas, a huge state with many powerful slaveholders. This annexation caused many in the North to worry about the Western spread of enslavers and the enslaved. At the same time, white workers feared that they would soon lose their jobs to the growing number of Black and immigrant laborers being placed in skilled positions along the East Coast and in the slaveholding South. At the Tredegar Iron Works in Richmond, Virginia, white workers went on strike in 1847. They demanded an increase in pay and the removal of the Negroes from skilled work. Enslavement wouldn't be abolished in Virginia for almost another 20 years, and these white workers hated, as they put it, being classed and associated with slaves. This strike was a huge deal, one of the first among white workers in the South, and it was part of a broader movement against enslaved labor at the time, meaning the movement did not focus on challenging the way enslaved people were terrorized to labor in fields and homes without pay. This movement went by the name Free Soil. One of its leaders was David Wilmot, a congressman from Pennsylvania. Congressman Wilmot wanted to end the Western spread of slavery because enslaved labor threatened the labor of white workers. Congressman Wilmot gave a speech in the House of Representatives claiming, "Where the Negro slave labors, the free white man cannot labor by his side without sharing in his degradation and disgrace." The workers on strike in 1847 wanted the skilled positions at Tredegar Iron Works to be free soil, but they had no problem with their free soil being surrounded by enslaved soil. Like other working-class Southern whites, the strikers had been taught since birth to value their race over their class. They used slogans such as, "Every laborer a slaveholder." Many white laborers aspired to be wealthy enslavers, just as many white working-class men aspire to be billionaire Donald Trump today. Many white laborers saw wealthy enslavers as their allies, but the feeling wasn't mutual. Then or now. Wealthy white enslavers viewed the white strikers as dangerous, kind of like free soilers up north. The white power structure of Richmond, Virginia, rallied behind the owners, not the workers, of Tredegar Iron Works. The strike dragged on from May to June 1847 without any victories. The iron workers dropped their wage grievance and, to a certain extent, toned down their racist rhetoric. The local newspaper reported that the objection to working with Negroes did not govern the strikers' action, but that it was the mere fear that the Negroes were intended hereafter to take their places. In the end, the white factory owners fired the white strikers, teaching them a lesson that Frederick Douglass would explain years later. The slaveholders, with the craftiness peculiar to themselves, by encouraging the enmity of the poor, laboring white man against the blacks, succeed in making the said white man almost as much a slave as the black slave himself. From the time of enslavement until today, the ruling elites have divided and conquered and subjugated working class white people and people of color. Welcome to Be Anti-Racist, an action podcast where we discuss how to diagnose, dismantle, and abolish racism, how to save humanity from the divisiveness of racist ideas and the destructiveness of racist power and policy, how to free humanity through the unity of anti-racist ideas and the constructiveness of anti-racist power and policy. On Be Anti-Racist, we discuss how to make the impossible possible and how to bring into being what modern humans have never known, a just and equitable world. You ready? Let's roll.
In the 1930s and 40s, the United States went on a nationwide building boom of public amenities funded by tax dollars, which in Montgomery, Alabama, included the Oak Park Pool. Except the Oak Park Pool was for whites only. When a federal court finally deemed this unconstitutional, the reaction of the town council was swift. They would drain the public pool rather than let black families swim too.
Heather McGee is an expert in economic and social policy and the author of the best-selling book, The Sum of Us, What Racism Costs Everyone and How We Can Prosper Together. Heather explodes one of the greatest racial myths that white people lose as people of color gain. She shows that as racism wins, we all lose. Heather is one of America's sharpest thinkers, the former president of the inequality-focused think tank Demos, and has drafted legislation, testified before Congress, and contributed regularly to news shows, including NBC's Meet the Press. She now chairs the board of Color of Change, the nation's largest online racial justice organization. I sat down with Heather McGee recently to learn how, by investing in each other, we can all achieve better jobs, better health, better democracy, better schools, better neighborhoods for our kids, and so much more. Heather, as always, it's truly an honor to speak with you. Your book, The Sum of Us, is the type of book that I learned from, that I think many Americans and many people around the world can learn from.
I wrote this book because I felt like we were missing something in the great pursuit of a society. It should be to have progress, to have people have less want and more joy, people to have more of the fruits of economic progress and technological progress, and for our problems to be solved generation after generation, right? And it felt like that progress was slowing down / reversing.
When some Americans imagine the transformation of this country, they imagine that they're going to lose if we actually create an equitable and just anti-racist America. And it seems, as you've written, that that's based on a zero-sum myth.
Mm-hmm. So I left a career in economic policy to go out on this quixotic journey in some ways to find the answer to the question of why can't we seem to have nice things and what are the roots of our dysfunction?
Yeah.
And it's there that I came upon this paradigm of the zero sum. It's a term that means there's no such thing as mutual progress. When you have people who are in a competition with one another, if team A scores one more point, team B scores one less point. The points will always add up to zero, positive on one side, negative on the other. Progress for team A has to come at the expense of team B. There's a limited or fixed pie. And that idea resonated so deeply with me. It sort of gave a name and a description to something I'd sensed my whole life. This fear that when white supremacy falls, that the world will become one that white people should fear.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, racism is really great for white people, really terrible for people of color. And so their self-interest is in preserving racism at all costs. And it's the at all costs piece that really felt so important for me to lay out. What are the costs of racism to our entire society? What exactly is the price white people are willing to pay to keep the system as it has been? And once I started looking, the list just kept growing.
Yeah.
And that made it clear to me that we have these self-interested elites packaging, marketing, selling this zero-sum lie to most white Americans. And they're doing it for their own profit. But our side, when we only talk about racism as something that's good for white people, are kind of like helping out a little bit, right?
Yeah.
My provocation, the agitation that made me feel like, okay, maybe I do have something to add to this conversation was, we haven't told the full story of what it has cost this entire country.
You were specifically writing about white folks who think that they're going to lose. But as a man of color reading it, I also think men of color too have bought into this myth of the zero sum.
Mm.
And I think that as they've seen women of color organizing and advocating and in some cases rising, they too have felt threatened as if they're losing.
Yeah.
But back to white folks, this is what I've been sort of saying, and I want to know whether I'm just wrong, that white Americans typically compare their lot to people of color.
Mm-hmm.
And so in other words, if their school has more resources, in a way their child's school is almost like a first class school, they're like, whoa, if we create equity, then I'm going to be back in coach.
Yeah.
I don't want that. I'm going to lose. My kid's going to lose.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems to me that white Americans should be assessing themselves from other white people in the Western
mm-hmm.
world.
Yeah.
And when they make that comparison, that's when they can see actually what they don't have, how they're in coach.
That's right. That's right. And in fact, maybe in other societies in the Western world, everybody's just in first class. There's no little curtain that the flight attendant moves exactly. over, right? Everyone gets food, right? Everyone has a leg room, you know, everybody gets to bring a bag. You know what I'm saying? This really comes from and is a feature of how brutally hierarchical our society is. In the first chapter of The Sum of Us, I go back in our history to the beginning to find out where this zero-sum worldview and this lie came from, whose interest it served, and why it sort of reanimated generation after generation. And as it turns out, it was created as a way to sort of discipline white Europeans in the colonial era to be satisfied with their lot in a society where wealth was still quite concentrated and where, because of chattel slavery and the plantation economy, there actually wasn't a lot of room.
Mm-hmm.
A white person who was not a plantation owner, their labor wasn't needed in the Southern economy, right? Like, what do we need you for, right? This myth of white supremacy was sold to white masses so that they could have, of course, as W.B. Du Bois said, the psychological wages of whiteness rather than material wages. And those psychological wages were knowing always that in a deeply unequal economy, they could nonetheless count on being more than and better than Black people.
Precisely. And of course, we're not as familiar with the roughly 5 million or so non-slaveholding, working class and poor whites, many of whom opposed secession during the Civil War,
mm-hmm.
many of whom rioted for food, many of whom sent their sons and fathers and brothers to the battlefields to die for slaveholders
mm-hmm.
who were maintaining their poverty as they were enslaving other people. And then, ironically, their great-great-grandchildren are now carrying around Confederate flags.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. That's the okey-doke, right? That is the way in which the lost cause ideology, which is just one more name and form of this big lie about white supremacy that communicates what white people's relative worth is to Black people and how they need to feel about Black people. You now have white people in the same breath deny that their family had anything to do with slavery, which might be true, but then deny that the Confederate flag is a symbol of slavery and attach themselves to what is a very cheap symbol of an aspirational status, right? That,
yes, yeah,
you know, didn't feed them then, isn't feeding them now. And what I try to do is to lay out how many things our country desperately needs. And by our country, I mean most people in this country, most people in a country where 1% of the population owns more wealth than the middle class. Most people in this country need a lot of things, and we can afford them, and we can rewrite the rules around the way business acts and operates in order to make sure that people who contribute to the profits and the wealth of our economy are getting their fair share of it. And yet the coalition that could make that happen on a consistent way is splintered because of the lie of the zero sum. Mm. And most importantly, the vehicles for collective action that would bring us shoulder to shoulder and allow us to have the power to get what we need out of society, government and labor unions, have been degraded in the white imagination because of racism. White Americans turn their backs on the pro-government, pro-labor formula that created the white middle class in the middle of the 20th century because of racism in the wake of the civil rights movement. I'm Heather C. McGee, and you're listening to Be Anti-Racist with Ibram X. Kendi.
I think the zero-sum game does not allow Americans to realize that we are part of a greater community, and we need to defend that greater community, because if we leave the community exposed, mm-hmm. we're going to become exposed. Yeah. And I think the chapter that for me exposed this the most was, of course, your chapter detailing what actually happened during the Great Recession.
I'm so glad you asked me about this chapter. It is the one that I am closest to because it was really the issue that I worked on for the first half of my career. The deregulation of the financial industry, which basically just means powerful people in the market can regulate themselves. Mm-hmm. If you say the people who should decide are the winners in the market, right? Oh, yeah. Who that? You know what I'm saying, right? That's not a lot of people of color. That's not a lot of women.
Exactly.
Right? So you're shifting who gets to decide how much workers are paid, how much people can pollute, how much people can charge on interest, not from the government, as most advanced societies do and have, but rather to the usually wealthy white men themselves. So the deregulation of the financial sector happened just around the time when the federal government was finally moving to end its explicitly racist practices of redlining and discriminating against Black would-be property owners and would-be customers of banks. So it was a perfect storm. And there are a couple of pieces of this that I try to say as much as possible because they're really flouting the conventional wisdom. Mm-hmm. One, often the idea is that this was people who needed subprime mortgages in order to buy their first home. And in fact, the majority of subprime mortgages were refinances. So it's people who already had homes who then got a refinance loan that often wound them up in foreclosure.
Wow.
So that's how you see a net loss in home ownership. And then, of course, second, the core myth is the idea that these were risky borrowers who shouldn't have been eligible for good credit. And therefore, it was sort of a risk that everybody took. The borrower took a risk, the lender took a risk, and whoops, it didn't work out. But that's not the case. In 2007, Wall Street Journal, huge study, all the subprime mortgage holders in the country, the majority of them had prime credit scores. Then why were there these subprime loans, which really just meant they were more expensive and had worse terms, more likely to end up in foreclosure? Why were they flourishing? Why were they one out of every five mortgages at the peak? And it was because they were so profitable. Mm. And how could they get away with it? Because they started in the late 1990s and early 2000s testing out this new exotic mortgage product on the people who were the least protected and the least respected by financial industry people and by regulators. The relative newcomers in many ways to home ownership, Black and brown homeowners in these sort of equity-rich, working and middle-class Black neighborhoods. So what happened was you started to see these massive foreclosures in the early 2000s. And as an advocate at that time for consumer protection, I was in many conversations with people who had the power to address a sort of quiet crisis that was burning through Black and brown neighborhoods before subprime became a household word. And it was so clear that the age-old stereotypes that equated Black people with risk were stopping them from seeing the crisis for what it was before it was too late. Mm. Literal quote from a Senate Banking Committee staffer was, "We put these people in homes when we shouldn't have." It's like, who's the we, right? Yeah. These are Black people who have scrimped and saved and by the very edge of their fingernails grabbed onto the American dream, despite everything that people in this room have done. And it was so heartbreaking to see so much predation and so much loss and so much indifference in the halls of power. And it wasn't until the formula was tested and perfected, and it was so profitable, that that machine fueled by racism and greed rolled over the rest of the wider and whiter mortgage market. Mm. And then we know where the story ends with the crash and the Great Recession.
It's just amazing how many livelihoods could have been saved during the Great Recession if people did not have a zero-sum perspective, mm-hmm. if people actually challenged racism. Mm-hmm. During the coronavirus pandemic, it was originally assumed that Black people were primarily being infected and killed because they were so lazy and obese and not taking the problem seriously. Mm-hmm. And then it led to this refusal to check the problem mm-hmm. aggressively. If anything, things were opened back up. Mm-hmm. And then by the end of the year, Middle America, states like the Dakotas mm-hmm. were facing the highest rates of infection and death. Mm-hmm. The number of white lives that could have been saved during the coronavirus if those white lives actually cared about Black lives.
Mm-hmm. The parallels are really profound.
Speaking about housing, you'll have some Americans who will say, okay, you know what? Yes, Heather, I could understand how that's a problem. Obviously, we should have taken those subprime mortgages seriously when they were attacking Black homebuyers. We shouldn't have seen Black people as the problem. Certainly, we can see how that led to the Great Recession. And I'm specifically talking about wealthy white Americans who are sitting right now in homogenous white neighborhoods. Mm-hmm. Who then can't make the connection between that problem mm-hmm. and the problem that you actually talk about in a chapter called Living Apart, mm-hmm. where you actually document that it's not just a racist idea that predominantly white schools and neighborhoods are good. It's actually demonstratively false. Mm-hmm. And it's not even good for white people.
Yeah, that's right. I wrote the chapter Living Apart to interrogate and flip on its head the way we normally think of segregation as something that white people do to people of color, to exclude us, to put us in a ghetto, to keep us away from all the good things for themselves inside. I want to just ask the question, what are the costs of segregation to our entire society? And yes, to white people too. There were a few big things that I discovered that helped me sort of pull together the whole picture. The first was a study that was done by the Urban Institute and the Metropolitan Planning Council in Chicago, my hometown, one of the most segregated cities in the country, to try to equip people who wanted to do something about integration, who were often getting pushback, right? Like, oh, how much is it going to cost us to site affordable housing in these richer neighborhoods? What's the cost of changing the status quo? And they came up with astronomical figures of lost lives, lost wealth, lost income, lost education because of segregation. Mm. And then I had this kind of common sense understanding that white people who are paying a lot to get the suburban house in the quote unquote good school district are actually like laying out cash in order to avoid what racism has wrought on public education, in order to avoid the neighborhoods that have too many Black and Brown people and where the test scores are not as high as they are in these white segregated schools. So I thought, okay, we can actually calculate that. Oh, it's 20-something thousand more dollars for a house that's the same as a house in a school district that's slightly less highly rated. But then I dug even deeper and it became clear that in fact, not only are white families often paying in order to segregate their children out of a sense that that is somehow going to be better for them, but it's not better for them.
Yeah, yeah.
The Brown versus Board of Education decision should have been when we stopped this madness. That should have been where the story of segregation in education ended. And of course it wasn't. I look at a part of the very famous social science appendix that was presented to the justices to make the case that segregation communicates negative stories to Black children about their own self-worth. And that was what the justices invoked in their decision. But there was another part of the appendix that basically laid out the psychological harms of segregation to white children.
Yes.
The moral disconnect, the ways in which being taught to assign your worth based on something as shallow as skin color was distorting to your personality and to your sense of identity formation, the ways in which it would create guilt feelings and then resentment, the ways that it would lean you towards authoritarianism was actually in this appendix. And I chuckle because nothing has changed, right? I mean, it seems like they could be talking about today. And so ultimately, for the justices not to rely on the full weight of the evidence, the full story, I think cost us something.
Yeah.
Because by suggesting that it is only bad for Black children not to be with white children, and not bad for white children not to be with Black children, we've actually maintained the myth that white is better. And it's that myth that is still operative today. And there's just a body of evidence that shows diversity basically makes white kids smarter. It makes them think with more rigor and creative problem solving. It sort of puts them on their game. And so these families that are sort of chasing the lily white school districts are actually losing out on the most powerful educational experience they could have, which is the real gift, right? I think diversity is America's superpower, and yet we so often don't tap into it.
You certainly have some white parents, just as you have parents of color, who recognize that at an interpersonal, intercultural level, they want their children to be exposed to difference. And they value that. They can't imagine raising an anti-racist child in an homogenous setting. Mm-hmm. So it's fascinating that, let's say you don't care about any of that. Right. All you want is a child who's a great student.
Yeah.
The studies show that too.
Yes, that's right.
But finally, let's turn to the solution, what you call the solidarity dividend. Yeah.
So in discovering that racism, more than any other factor, is what is keeping Americans from having nice things, the flip side, it actually becomes easier to conceive of progress on all of these big economic and social challenges if we come together across lines of race. And that's what I began calling the solidarity dividend. It's all these gains that we can unlock by coming together to find solutions to our common problems. Things like higher wages, better rates of unionization, more healthcare, cleaner air, better funded schools. These are all the things that we are denying ourselves as a people, basically because of the belief in this zero-sum racial hierarchy and because of the phenomenon of seeing public goods wither in this country because support has been degraded as the public has grown to include more people of color whom white people have been taught to disdain and distrust. That's how we got here from having the greatest middle class the world had ever seen to being one of the most unequal societies in the world. But if we refill the pool of public goods for everyone, That's a solidarity dividend. And the only way we can get there is through cross-racial solidarity. I think in many ways, it is our destiny in this country, right? As we quickly become a country with no racial majority, we can dismantle the lie of racial hierarchy. And when we do that, when we stand up for one another, when we see that there's a fire raging in Black communities and we don't think, well, that's something wrong with Black people, but rather we say, let's fix that problem now. We get a solidarity dividend of the United States having the best in the world coronavirus response, right? We could have done that. We were sort of set up to do that with all of our resources, all of that. And yet so many of the ways that we failed and that we had one of the worst, certainly the worst in the advanced economy world, was because of racism and because of the public goods that we don't have. You know, we could have had a society where the response was, let us move towards one another, let us protect one another, let us make sure that the essential workers have everything they need in order to still work, and let us pay people to stay home, right?
Exactly. Other countries.
Exactly. When we weren't really equipped for that, and I think a large part of the reason why we weren't was because of racist indifference, because of the racist draining of public goods and public services and benefits, and because we have this fractured political debate, which is so rooted in racist fear-mongering and scapegoating. And so when I say that we can have a solidarity dividend in this country, it's that we can have, frankly, a little bit of what we're seeing right now in our politics. We had a multiracial, anti-racist majority that voted in a change in our politics in November, and then wading through high water to vote in January to give a slim majority to a party that was promising to address the challenges of inequality, the pandemic, corruption in our democracy, climate change, and racial justice. And out of the gate, a rescue plan that cuts child poverty in half to remind us that Black, white, and brown poverty is a policy choice. That's a solidarity dividend. Real family leave and childcare, which was defeated in the early 1970s because of the fears of integration, having that in this country finally, that's a solidarity dividend.
How does someone carry out the solidarity dividend and refill the pools?
Yeah, I think it's so important. I mean, I'm a policy wonk. That's been my career. But after the journey to write The Sum of Us, I'm more and more in love with the transformative power of organizing. And thankfully, we are in a sort of boom time for organizing. People have taken action through the Trump era and through this pandemic more so than in generations. And so we have to keep going. I do believe that finding an issue is really a good way to start. Pick a local issue that means a lot and work with your neighbors to change the rules to allow for more opportunity for everyone. I don't want people to be stuck reading our books, right? I want people to read the books, close them, take action, pick up the phone, go online, pick up a clipboard and go next door, right? I think that is where people ultimately have the most enduring consciousness change. I'm reminded of a woman whom I met in Kansas City named Bridget, who was a lifelong fast food worker, minimum wage worker, white woman who, you know, believed the anti-immigrant, anti-Black narratives that her community and her family had believed and taught to her, the kind of right-wing fear-mongering and scapegoating. And she also believed that her own labor was never going to be worth more than $7.25 an hour. But it was when she was approached to join an organizing meeting with the Fight for 15 in the union that she saw a Latina woman stand up and talk about her own life, you know, having three kids and a house with bad plumbing. And she said, I saw myself in her, and something switched. And through the act of organizing for something that would lift both of them, she was able to put away those racist ideas. And as she says to me now, it's not a matter of us versus them. For us to come up, they've got to come up. As long as we're divided, we're conquered. She says, racism is bad for white people too, because it keeps us divided from our Black and brown brothers and sisters. that consciousness change for a white woman who should have firmly been in the sort of Trump camp comes from organizing. And that's what I think we need to do all across this country.
Precisely. I could not agree more. And to echo, as they would say in the 60s, to those who were just reading and learning, they would say, stop being those armchair radicals. Yes. We need you to get up and fight and organize. Thank you so much for your brilliance, for your work, for your book, The Sum of Us, and for taking some time to join this community.
Thank you. Thank you, Abel.
The zero-sum myth claims that progress for people of color means a loss for white people, as Heather writes in The Sum of Us. This is the fable that racist power has peddled for centuries. Before and after the Civil War, it was the fable that the free soilers and factory owners alike told white workers in both the North and the South. And Tredegar Iron Works ended up producing over half of the armament that was used during the Civil War by the Confederacy. We lost more than 600,000 lives during the Civil War, more American lives than any other war in history. When we buy into the zero sum, we all lose, just like the white workers who struck at Tredegar Iron Works in 1847 lost. But when we change the game and work in coalition, we all win together. Yet racial division continues to depress and deplete us. We can come together across our racial, cultural, and historical differences and cash in on our solidarity dividend, as Heather calls it. And the dividend pays off in higher wages, better housing, quality schools, cleaner air, safer neighborhoods, and elected officials who are responsible to us and not special interests. Tangible benefits that improve the lives of Black, Indigenous, Latinx, and Asian people also improve the lives of white people. My conversation with Heather showed us how we can each contribute to the solidarity dividend and why the zero-sum fable has such a deep hold on our national consciousness. We should throw our political weight behind policymakers and policies that universalize the essentials of life, like basic income, housing, and healthcare. But that's only the beginning. We must target our resources to create equity between groups. We need equitable policies that ensure the groups with the greatest needs are provided the most. We must stop battling against each other and start battling against racism. All together, we must be anti-racist.
Be Anti-Racist is a production of Pushkin Industries and iHeartMedia. It is written and hosted by Dr. Ibram X. Kendi and produced by Alexandra Garrettin with associate producer Brittany Brown. Our engineer is Ben Talladay, our editor is Julia Barton, and our showrunner is Sasha Mathias. Our executive producers are Lital Mulad and Mia Lobel. Many thanks to Tammy Nguyen and Dr. Heather Sanford at the Center for Anti-Racist Research at Boston University for all of their help. At Pushkin, thanks to Heather Fain, Carly Migliori, John Schnars, and Jacob Weisberg. You can find Dr. Kendi on Twitter at @drEbram and on Instagram at @EbramXK. You can find Pushkin on all social platforms at Pushkin Pods, and you can sign up for our newsletter at pushkin.fm. To find more Pushkin podcasts, listen on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you like to listen.